but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights in the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqtad. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, The other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticized for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explained that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody. Every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for non-Muslims to come to our mosque to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day, and during this activity, five women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth. and who took no helper when he authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Fires at Aramco oil facilities in Jeddah are burning after a brutal attack by the Yemeni army. Saudi Arabia has failed to put out the fire as of yet. This is while Yemen is marking 7 years of the bombing campaign and war by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. and the Saudi-backed coalition. Will Saudi Arabia come to its senses and realize it is losing this war? or does it need the green light from the U.S., which seems content to continue selling it arms? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me introduce our guests. Writer, journalist, and political analyst Hafsat Kara Mustafa joins us from London. Also joining us, political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell, who joins us from Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Brian Terrell, let me first start with you. We need to talk about this and ask you your thoughts on this Yemeni operation that took place called Breaking the Siege 3, as they have called it. And it was executed against a number of vital and sensitive targets deep inside Saudi Arabia. They used domestically developed ballistic and winged missiles, as well as combat drones. And you had the strike today that involved that, and then you had the strike just days ago. Again, a number of installations to have been targeted. So what is your reaction to that? And please take into account, if you can for us, or to put into context, the advances made by the Yemeni army versus the Saudi-backed coalition, who has all these funds and all the resources that it needs to carry out the bombing campaign.
Well, yes. First of all, 7 years is intolerable, and we're adding humanitarian disaster upon humanitarian disaster around the world, and they're all manufactured. None of this is necessary. All this suffering. I think that the as I see what's happening in the last few days, and I speak as a pacifist, and I don't think there's a military solution to anything. But I also see that for all of the technology that's given and sold, and all the intelligence that the Saudis have at their disposal, and how they're carrying on this war with fantastic civilian casualties and attacking civilian infrastructure, and what's happening in these last few days with far fewer resources. Much more carefully orchestrated attacks on the oil infrastructure and other targets with very little collateral damage and that's really something remarkable. But I think one of the first questions you asked in this introduction is, will the Saudis be able to end this without a green light from the United States because of all the money that this is making for U.S. corporations? Just over a year ago, February, I believe the 7th of last year, President Biden made his first public address on after his election on foreign affairs, and he announced great fanfare. We are ending all U.S. American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen. And he called it a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe. He joined the world in condemning the horrible blockade and war of attrition against the Yemeni people. And immediately that was stepped back from much more quietly, and much more quietly, millions of dollars worth of sales have been approved, of missiles made by Raytheon and other U.S. corporations to the Saudis. I don't think this is intended by the United States anyway. I hope that the Saudis have more sense for this to ever end at all. This is a status quo to be maintained because it's very profitable.
Well, Hafsa Khair Mostafa, looking at the media in the U.S., many portray this picture that there's confusion on the part of the Biden administration. I'm wondering what confusion there is, as our guest there said, where you have a president who comes out and said, I'm going to end the war. But in reality, what we're seeing in terms of action is more arms are being sold, the latest one being $750 million.
Well, I think we have to remember that this, for the U.S., is a perfect war. It's a war that generates a lot of money, but then doesn't generate a single U.S. Victim, a U.S. soldier being sacrificed on the battleground. So this is, in essence, a perfect conflict for a country that is war-hungry and whose economy is highly reliant on the industrial war complex. So I think there's absolutely no incentive for the U.S. government to put an end to it. On the contrary, it has all the incentive to pursue it, in particular as Saudi Arabia has a lot of money, will have even more money now that oil prices have gone up, and therefore will have the financial means to continue to buy arms and therefore continue to nourish this sector of the U.S. economy. So on the U.S. side, there is absolutely no incentive. And if anything else, they're going to encourage this conflict to continue. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that the Saudis really need to cut their losses. They started out in this conflict claiming that it would be a two-week thing, that it would be done within the end of the month. And obviously, 7 years on, here we are. And the Houthis are being more and more efficient, digging deeper in Saudi and actually targeting very, very sensitive areas. So I think what the best outcome would be for Saudi Arabia to realize that it hasn't made a single achievement, that it's not gaining any ground against the Houthis, and that in essence, today, it is very similar to what the U.S. was against the Afghans or against Vietnam, far more well-equipped, yet faced with a very, very determined opponent.
Brian Terrell, let me review this with you, because it's really something that needs to be reviewed. The strike that happened today, Yemen's army fired missiles and drones. Let's see here. The Saudi energy and water desalination facilities. It pounded high-value sites in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Energy facilities in the strategic Jizan and Nadran regions, Aramco's fuel distribution station in the Red Sea port city of Jeddah. Days ago, drone strikes hit a petroleum product distribution terminal in the southern Jizan region, a natural gas plant, and you see where I'm going with this. So when you're sitting in the control room, whether it's in Saudi Arabia or in the U.S., what are they thinking? I mean, I'm wondering, when they spent all this money, all this technology, all the intelligence, and we hear a lot of it comes from the U.S., but they're suffering such losses. I mean, their jewel is Aramco. I'm guessing they should really put that into context and try to get some kind of political solution going immediately.
Yes, I think it is that urgent. It's that urgent to us and to all the people of the world. It's that urgent to the people of Saudi Arabia. It's that urgent as we're facing climate change, and we need to find alternatives and develop more efficient uses of the fuel that we have and find other fuels, we're spending all of our treasure on this. It's not a disaster if you are a major shareholder in Raytheon or in Boeing or some of these other corporations. It's seen as good news, as the CEO of Raytheon said back in February in response to the president's speech. He said, "Peace is not going to break out anytime soon." He assured the stockholders, and that he predicted that the Middle East would remain an area of solid, positive growth. This is how twisted it is that the people who have to gain from this see this. They don't see this in terms of human suffering, and they don't even see this in terms of bringing the world to the brink of a world war. They don't see this in terms of millions of people starving to death. They're seeing the bottom line, and it looks good. And there isn't any incentive to change course. And the world the whole world needs a radical shift in course, but we're not going to see it from the people who are running the military-industrial complex and the politicians here in the United States that they own.
Well, Hafsakar Mustafa, since we're talking about this war, to have entered the 7 years is what we're also looking at in terms of its anniversary, which is a really depressing milestone. At some point, about 3 or 4 years into the war, there were reports that were coming out that the Saudi-led coalition at that point, there were a number of countries, it wasn't just the UAE and Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., that they were actually targeting infrastructure, whether it was agricultural infrastructure or infrastructure, for example, water or the likes, which all point to the fact that they were trying to either starve the population or lead to the death of the civilians. Is that? Do you think that was one of the intentions behind the bombing campaign that happens, that they were actually going after the civilian population?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no doubt about that. And we also know that Saudi Arabia has committed actual war crimes under the very standard definition of war crimes. The idea, presumably politically, would be to carry out such punitive operations against civilians that the civilians would turn against their army and actually force it to stop. But that hasn't happened. If anything, it's sort of pushed many Yemenis who were perhaps on a middle ground actually more towards the Houthi operations, because they realize that they're being punished and they're being murdered and slaughtered at the hands of a very oppressive Saudi regime that has absolutely complete disregard for Yemeni, for fellow Arab and fellow Muslim life. And this is very interesting, because obviously this is a country that has very, very similar, very close ties historically, ethnically, religiously with Yemen, and yet it isn't hesitating in carrying out these very atrocious operations against essentially what is a brotherly nation. So I think that noticing and realizing that has actually pushed many civilians in Yemen to side with the Houthis when prior to that they may not have been. So this, again, these operations have had the reverse effect of what Saudi Arabia was trying to achieve all those years ago. And so the harder they go on Yemen, the more losses they actually record on the strategic grounds.
Okay, another point that is very interesting is that Yemen has come out in the past on a number of occasions. Actually, at this point, very recently, the Yemeni information minister coming out saying, you know, we're going to stop these missile strikes and our drone strikes on various targets in Saudi Arabia if the siege is lifted. Now, Saudi Arabia, for some reason, is not lifting that siege, Brian Terrell. It may be concerned about arms being transferred, perhaps, but that's a simple solution. I don't think that they're that incompetent to search UN-approved shipments that are supposed to be coming through into the territory and spread humanitarian, that is, goods to the Yemeni people. So why is it that that is not being done? Why is Saudi Arabia keen on keeping the siege?
Well, I think these most of these problems that seem intractable have simple solutions. Like you said, that lifting that siege is a simple solution, and it could only lead to positive developments. I think we have to remember that this a few days ago, March 12th, that there was the Saudis carried out an execution, a mass execution of 81 men, women, and children. Even were beheaded by the Saudi kingdom. Some of them were specifically executed because they opposed the war in Yemen. And then 2 days later, the coalition invites the Yemeni leadership to come to Riyadh and for peace talks. And of course they're not going to come to Riyadh for peace talks. It was an absurd, obscene invitation, and showing that there isn't any on the side of the Saudi coalition any interest in peace, because of course they'd be risking their own lives by traveling to Saudi Arabia at the time. So there just isn't any this war would stop if there was a will to stop it. If there was a will on the part of the Saudis, a will on the part of the United States, there's certainly among the leadership in Yemen and the people of Yemen. They have every interest in stopping this war. And if that interest was met on the other side, it would simply end. These are not intractable problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, an interesting development came, Hafsakar Mustafa, just hours ago, where prior to that you had the attack that happened by the Yemeni army on the Saudi oil facilities. But just a couple hours back, you had a major announcement. The way I'm looking at it, I'm not too sure if you agree or not, if you can tell us what it means. First, that the Ansarullah movement made an announcement that it will be suspending strikes in Saudi Arabia for a period of 3 days. So that's one of the statements they made. The other was that they were ready to release all war prisoners. What do you make of those two announcements?
Well, I think this is a position that implies that they've got the upper hand and the Saudis are in a weak position. And it's sort of allowing them to take stock of all the losses they've made and perhaps come back to the negotiating table and find a solution. Clearly, despite the gains, the military gains, I would say, on the Yemeni side, the losses on civilian and on infrastructure has been huge on the Yemeni side. And I think it's fair to say that obviously Yemen wants to see an end to this. So I think it is on the side of those who are making great military gains to actually tell the Saudis that this is your moment to take stock. Ramadan is coming up. This is a very unpopular conflict at the moment. And I think maybe, just maybe, if you take time to realize that you're gaining absolutely nothing from this, then you would take the wise decision. And I think it's sort of an appeal to wisdom over anything else.
I'd like to test your memory over here, if I may, Brian Terrell. Prior to the year 2015, when this war was launched, you had the AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, to be cited as the number one threat, national security threat for the U.S. I don't know if you recall that. There was an incident that happened with U.S. sailors. And then there were reports that surfaced on more than one occasion in this war after it began that you actually had the Saudi-backed coalition, which involves a lot of mercenaries also, but you had them fighting the AQ, the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, actually fighting alongside the coalition members on the ground. And many of the weapons that they had were American weapons, which as usual distributed to the UAE or Saudi Arabia or the coalition members, but ending up in the hands of Al-Qaeda. Would you consider that one of the low points and also a sign of desperation in order to defeat the Yemeni army and the Ansarullah fighters?
Oh, yes. It's an embarrassment. And we've seen the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, well, it didn't exist before the invasion of Iraq. These are the fruits of the war, so-called war on terrorism. What's been happening since, for all these years too, even before this war that began 7 years ago, the United States has been carrying on a war in Yemen with its own mercenaries and its drone attacks, that has been going on, consistently and. Undermining the democracy and the social, the civic and economic life of Yemen. So this has been Yemen has been a battleground, for different forces This is not Yemen's fight, but we're the United States is often finding itself, very often finding itself, whether it's in Syria or Afghanistan, in Yemen, supporting and profiting off of the different sides of these different conflicts and exacerbating them.
A bit confusing, Hafsakar Mustafa, the relationship that the UAE and Saudi Arabia have in terms of their objectives. Because we hear more about, for example, the UAE being involved with Israel because it has normalized ties with Israel. Socotra Island, supposedly, they have set up a a spying center there, and they're really interested in the ports. Of course, they want to have some control over that Bab el-Mandab Strait, for example. And even at some point, there were clashes between the UAE-backed fighters and the other fighters backed by Saudi Arabia, I guess, if that's a correct interpretation. What are the objectives of the UAE that diverge from Saudi Arabia, in your opinion?
I think the UAE, because especially through Dubai, has become some sort of powerhouse, economic powerhouse, and a major financial and trading and touristic hub. It's actually trying to impose itself now politically. And there's no better way, in a way, than to impose yourself on the battleground and show that you are actually a force to be reckoned with. So I think because within the GCC groups, the main contender has always been Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia has always flexed its muscle on the smaller countries of the region, this is the opportunity for the UAE to show that not only is it a more economical powerhouse, but actually it can even hold itself militarily. And obviously through its newly found alliance with the very powerful Israel that enjoys incredible military support from the US, I think it feels that now it can flex its muscle even more in terms of controlling certain major trading routes and actually imposing itself on as a military base of actual importance locally.
Okay, and Brian Terrell, we're quickly running out of time over here. I'm looking down a list of incidents that have been major in terms of the number of civilian casualties that have been killed, from whole entire families being wiped out. And many of these incidents that I'm looking at also cite U.S.-made weapons, obviously, that have been used. And then I'm looking at the U.S. President Joe Biden calling Putin a war criminal. I'm trying to put that into my logic here as to how he can call Putin that, yet we see what's unfolding in Yemen. What do you think?
Oh, don't stress yourself too hard on that, because you can't. I think also just the other day, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, made a speech about condemning the destructive behavior, reckless terrorist attacks by the Ansar Allah, by Yemen on Saudi Arabia, and of course he's not condemning the attacks of Saudi Arabia on Yemen. No, we're seeing a tremendous hypocrisy, and is horrific and totally to be condemned. The Russian attack on Ukraine, to see it in the world context, it is, the United States and its allies and NATO have created, have invaded many countries, created right now millions of refugees who are not being welcomed by the countries of Europe, not being welcomed by the United States, fomenting wars and economic disasters in Central America and South America, sure. And the refugees from those wars are starving in the desert sure. South of the United States, and their children are in cages. There are people drowning in the Mediterranean who are trying to escape the U.S. wars in Libya and in Syria. And I have many friends in Afghanistan who are trying to get out from those wars. So the hypocrisy of it is more than breathtaking. It's as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1967, he said that we have to face the fact that the United States is the biggest purveyor of violence in the world.
Okay.
And that wasn't popular then, and it's not popular now, even though it's more true now than it was in 1967.
30 seconds to you, Hafsakar Mustafa. Biden talks about a new world order, and it wants to lead it. Do you think that it will lead when it comes to ending this war?
Absolutely. I think we are facing a new world order, but perhaps not in the sense that Blinken wants it or imagines it. I think this war in Ukraine has revealed a lot of the hypocrisies and a lot of the double standards, and I think it is making people take stock, and we're seeing shifting grounds today. But I think for the global South, it is actually shifting in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. Hafsakar Mustafa there, writer, journalist, and political analyst from London. Brian Terrell, thank you so much, political commentator and peace activist from Molloy, Iowa. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitaly. It's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There will be no prosecution of Saudi Arabian rulers for their war crimes committed in Yemen or for the U.S. military and political leadership for the war crimes they carried out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, or a generation earlier in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, says Chris Hedges, journalist, in an article published under the heading War Crimes and the Lie of American Innocence. Stay tuned for more. We know who the most recent war criminals are. Coming others: George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, General Ricardo Sanchez, former CIA Director George Tenet, former Assistant Attorney General J. Bybee, former Department Assistant Attorney General John Yoo, who set up the legal framework to authorize torture, the helicopter pilots who gunned down civilians, including two Reuters journalists in the collateral murder video released by WikiLeaks. We have evidence of the crimes they committed. Julian Assange, even though he is not a U.S. citizen and his WikiLeaks site is not a U.S.-based publication, is charged under the U.S. Espionage Act for making public numerous war crimes. Assange, currently housed in a high-security prison in London, is fighting a losing battle in the British courts to block his extradition to the United States, where he faces 175 years in prison. We must demand justice for those who were wounded, became sick, or died because the United States destroyed hospitals and infrastructure. We must demand justice for the 38 million people who have been displaced or become refugees in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, and Syria, a number that exceeds the total of all those displaced in all wars since 1900. Apart from the Second World War, according to the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University.
Every effort to hold American war criminals accountable has been rebuffed by Congress, by the courts, by the media, and by two ruling political parties. The Center for Constitutional Rights, blocked by bringing cases in the U.S. courts against the architects of these preemptive wars, which are defined by post-Nuremberg laws as criminal wars of aggression, filed motions in German courts to hold U.S. leaders to account for gross violations of the Geneva Convention, including the sanctioning of torture in black sites such as Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. Why weren't sanctions imposed on the United States of America? Why weren't those who defended their countries from foreign invasion in the West Asia, North Africa region, including Palestinians under Israeli regime occupation, also provided with thousands of anti-tank weapons, anti-armor weapons, anti-aircraft weapons, helicopters, switchblade or kamikaze drones, hundreds of Stinger anti-aircraft systems, Javelin anti-tank missiles, machine guns, and millions of rounds of ammunition? Well, we know why. U.S. war crimes don't count, and neither do the victims for the U.S. war crimes. And this hypocrisy makes a rules-based world, one that abides by international law, impossible. This hypocrisy is not new. Mass death and fireballs on a city skyline are the calling cards Americans have left across the globe for decades. The deliberate targeting of civilians, whether in Baghdad, Gaza, or New York City, are all American war crimes. So is the killing of 230,000 people over the past 7 years in Yemen, from Saudi bombing campaigns and blockades that have resulted in mass starvation and cholera epidemics. Where were the calls for a no-fly zone over Gaza and Yemen? Imagine how many lives could have been saved. War crimes demand the same moral judgment and accountability, but they don't get them. And they don't get them because Americans have one set of standards for white Europeans and another for non-white people around the globe. The Second World War began with an understanding, at least by the Allies, that employing industrial weapons against civilian populations was a war crime. But within 18 months of the start of the war, the Germans, Americans, and British were relentlessly bombing cities. By the end of the war, one-fifth of German homes had been destroyed. 1 million German civilians were killed or wounded in bombing raids. 7.5 million Germans were made homeless. The tactic of saturation bombing or area bombing, which included the firebombing of Dresden, Hamburg, and Tokyo, which killed more than 90,000 Japanese civilians in Tokyo and left 1 million people homeless, and the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which took the lives of between 129,000 and 226,000 people, most of whom were civilians, and the sole purpose of breaking the morale of the population through mass death and terror. It turned the architects of modern war, all of them, into war criminals. Civilians in every war since have been considered legitimate targets. In the summer of 1965, then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara called the bombing raids north of Saigon that left hundreds of thousands of dead an effective means of communication with the government in Hanoi. McNamara, 6 years before he died, unlike most war criminals, had the capacity for self-reflection. Interviewed in the documentary The Fog of War, he was repentant, not only about targeting Vietnamese civilians, but about the aerial targeting of civilians in Japan in the Second World War, overseen by Air Force General Curtis LeMay. LeMay said, if we'd lost the war, we'd all have been prosecuted as war criminals, McNamara said in the film, adding, "And I think he's right. Lomé recognized that what he was doing would be thought immoral if his side had lost. But what makes it immoral if you lose and not immoral if you win?" Industrial killing defines modern warfare. It is impersonal mass slaughter. It is administered by vast bureaucratic structures that perpetuate the killing over months and years. It is sustained by heavy industry that produces a steady flow of weapons, munitions, tanks, planes, helicopters, battleships, submarines, missiles, and mass-produced supplies, along with mechanized transports that ferry troops and armaments by rail, ship, cargo planes, and trucks to the battlefield. It mobilizes industrial, governmental, and organizational structures for total war. It centralizes systems of information and internal control. It is rationalized for the public by specialists and experts drawn from the military establishment, along with pliant academics and the media. Industrial war destroys existing value systems that protect and nurture life, replacing them with fear, hatred, and dehumanization of those who are made to believe deserve to be exterminated. It is driven by emotions, not truth or fact. It obliterates nuisance, replacing it with an infantile binary universe of Americans and them. It drives competing narratives, ideas, and values underground and vilifies all who do not speak in the national cant that replaces civil discourse and debate. It is touted as an example of the inevitable march of human progress, when in fact it brings Americans closer and closer to mass obliteration and nuclear catastrophe. It mocks the concept of individual heroism despite the feverish efforts of the military and the mass media to sell this myth, this legend, to naive young recruits and a gullible public. Of course, there will be no prosecution of Saudi Arabian rulers for the war crimes committed in Yemen or for the U.S. military and political leadership for the war crimes they carried out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, or a generation earlier in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The atrocities Americans commit, such as My Lai, where 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians were gunned down by U.S. troops, which are made public, are dealt with by finding a scapegoat, usually a low-ranking officer who is given a symbolic sentence. Lieutenant William Kelly served 3 years under house arrest for the killing of At My Lai. 11 U.S. troops, none of whom were officers, were convicted of torture at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. But the architects and the overlords of U.S. industrial slaughter, including Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, General Curtis LeMay, Harry S. Truman, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, Lyndon Johnson, General William Westmoreland, George W. Bush, General David Petraeus, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden are never held to account. They leave power to become venerated elder statesmen. The mass slaughter of industrial warfare, the failure to hold Americans to account, to see American face in the war criminals they condemn, will have ominous consequences. Politicians and generals wield their destructive fury as if they were toys. Those who decry the madness, who demand the rule of law, are attacked and condemned. These industrial weapon systems are U.S. modern idols.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.